of meaning common to all human languages. Wrong in two ways, we shall see. I know that Chomsky's books of the last 25 years are sitting on a high shelf in the author's study, their spines uncracked, their folios uncut. Many people want to have a go at speculating about the mind, but have the same impatience about mastering the details of how language works that Eliza Doolittle showed to Henry Higgins in Pygmalion, when she complained, "I don't want to talk grammar. I want to talk like a lady in a flower shop." For non-specialists, the reaction is even more extreme. In Shakespeare's The Second Part of King Henry VI, the rebel Dick the Butcher speaks the well-known line, "The first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers." Less well-known is the second thing Dick suggests they do, "Behead Lord Say." Why? Here is the indictment presented by the mob's leader, Jack Cade. "Thou hast most treacherously corrupted the youth of the realm in erecting a grammar school. It will be proved to thy face that thou hast men about thee that usually talk of a noun and a verb, and such abominable words as no Christian ear can endure to hear." And who can blame the grammarphobe when a typical passage from one of Chomsky's technical works reads as follows? To summarize, we have been led to the following conclusions on the assumption that the trace of a zero-level category must be properly governed. 1. VP is alpha-marked by I. 2. Only lexical categories are L-markers, so that VP is not L-marked by I. 3. Alpha government is restricted to sisterhood without the qualification. 35. 4. Only the terminus of an X-zero power chain can alpha-mark or case-mark. 5. Head-to-head movement forms an A-chain. 6. Spec-head agreement and chains evolve the same indexing. 7. Chain co-indexing holds of the links of an extended chain. 8. There is no accidental co-indexing of I. 9. IV co-indexing is a form of head-head agreement. If it is restricted to aspectual verbs, then base-generated structures of the form 174 count as adjunction structures. 10. Possibly a verb does not properly govern its alpha-marked complement. All this is unfortunate. People, especially those who hold forth on the nature of mind, should be just plain curious about the code that the human species uses to speak and understand. In return, the scholars who study language for a living should see that such curiosity can be satisfied. Chomsky's theory need not be treated by either group as a set of Kabbalistic incantations that only the initiated can mutter. It is a set of discoveries about the design of language that can be appreciated intuitively if one first understands the problems to which the theory provides solutions. In fact, grasping grammatical theory provides an intellectual pleasure that is rare in the social sciences. When I entered high school in the late 1960s and electives were chosen for their relevance, Latin underwent a steep decline in popularity. Thanks to students like me, I confess. Our Latin teacher, Mrs. Willie, whose merry birthday parties for Rome failed to slow the decline, tried to persuade us that Latin grammar honed the mind with its demands for precision, logic, and consistency. Nowadays, such arguments are more likely to come from the computer programming teachers. Mrs. Willie had a point, but Latin declensional paradigms are not the best way to convey the inherent beauty of grammar. The insights behind universal grammar are much more interesting, not only because they are more general and elegant, but because they are about living minds rather than dead tongues. Let's start with nouns and verbs. Your grammar teacher may have had you memorize some formula that equated parts of speech with kinds of meanings like, "A noun's the name of anything, as school or garden, hoop or swing." Verbs tell of something being done, to read, count, sing, laugh, jump, or run. but as in most matters about language, she did not get it quite right. It is true that most names for persons, places, and things are nouns, but it is not true that most nouns are names for persons, places, or things. There are nouns with all kinds of meanings. The destruction of the city, an action. The way to San Jose, a path. Whiteness moves downward, a quality. 3 miles along the path, a measurement in space. It takes 3 hours to solve the problem, a measurement in time. Tell me the answer, what the answer is, a question. She is a fool, a category or kind, a meeting, an event. The square root of -2, an abstract concept. He finally kicked the bucket. No meaning at all. Likewise, though words for things being done, such as count and jump, are usually verbs, verbs can be other things, like mental states, know, like, possession, own, have, and abstract relations among ideas, falsify, prove. Conversely, a single concept, like being interested, can be expressed by different parts of speech. Her interest in fungi, noun. Fungi are starting to interest her more and more. Verb. She seems interested in fungi. Fungi seem interesting to her. Adjective. Interestingly, the fungi grew an inch in an hour. Adverb. A part of speech, then, is not a kind of meaning. It is a kind of token that obeys certain formal rules, like a chess piece or a poker chip. A noun, for example, is simply a word that does nouny things. It is the kind of word that comes after an article, can have an S stuck onto it, and so on. There is a connection between concepts in part of speech categories, but it is a subtle and abstract one. When we construe an aspect of the world as something that can be identified and counted or measured, and that can play a role in events, language often allows us to express that aspect as a noun, whether or not it is a physical object. For example, when we say, "I have 3 reasons for leaving," we are counting reasons as if they were objects, though of course we do not literally think that a reason can sit on a table or be kicked across a room. Similarly, when we construe some aspect of the world as an event or state involving several participants that affect one other, language often allows us to express that aspect as a verb. For example, when we say, "The situation justified drastic measures," we are talking about justification as if it were something the situation did. Though again we know that justification is not something we can watch happening at a particular time and place. Nouns are often used for names of things and verbs for something being done, but because the human mind can construe reality in a variety of ways, nouns and verbs are not limited to those uses. Now, what about the phrases that group words into branches? One of the most intriguing discoveries of modern linguistics is that there appears to be a common anatomy in all phrases in all the world's languages. Take the English noun phrase. A noun phrase, NP, is named after one special word, a noun, that must be inside it. The noun phrase owes most of its properties to that one noun. For example, the NP, the cat in the hat, refers to a kind of cat, not a kind of hat. The meaning of the word cat is the core of the meaning of the whole phrase. Similarly, the phrase "fox in socks" refers to a fox, not socks, and the entire phrase is singular in number. That is, we say that the fox in socks is or was here, not are or were here, because the word fox is singular in number. This special noun is called the head of the phrase, and the information filed with that word in memory percolates up to the topmost node, where it is interpreted as characterizing the phrase as a whole. The same goes for verb phrases. "Flying to Rio before the police catch him" is an example of flying, not an example of catching. So the verb flying is called its head. Here we have the first principle of building the meaning of a phrase out of the meaning of the words inside the phrase. What the entire phrase is about is what its head word is about. The second principle allows phrases to refer not just to single things or actions in the world, but to sets of players that interact with each other in a particular way, each with a specific role. For example, the sentence, "Sergei gave the documents to the spy," is not just about any old act of giving. It choreographs three entities: Sergei, the giver, documents, the gift, and a spy, the recipient. These role players are usually called arguments, which has nothing to do with bickering. It's the term used in logic and mathematics for a participant in a relationship. A noun phrase, too, can assign roles to one or more players, as in picture of John, governor of California, and sex with Dick Cavett, each defining one role. The head and its role players, other than the subject role, which is special, are joined together in a subphrase smaller than an NP or a VP that has the kind of non-mnemonic label that has made generative linguistics so uninviting. N-bar and V-bar, named after the way they are written, with a bar over each capital letter. The third ingredient of a phrase is one or more modifiers, usually called adjuncts. A modifier is different from a role player. Take the phrase, "the man from Illinois." Being a man from Illinois is not like being governor of California. To be a governor, you have to be a governor of something. The Californian-ness plays a role in what it means for someone to be governor of California. In contrast, from Illinois is just a bit of information that we add on to help identify which man we are talking about. Being from one state or another is not an inherent part of what it means to be a man. This distinction in meaning between role players and modifiers, arguments and adjuncts in lingo, dictates the geometry of the phrase structure tree. The role player stays next to the head noun inside the N-bar, but the modifier goes upstairs, though still inside the NP house. This restriction of the geometry of phrase structure trees is not just playing with notation. It is a hypothesis about how the rules of language are set up in our brains, governing the way we talk. It dictates that if a phrase contains both a role player and a modifier, the role player has to be closer to the head than the modifier is. There's no way the modifier could get between the head noun and the role player without crossing branches in the tree, that is, sticking extraneous words in among the bits of the end bar, which is illegal. Consider Ronald Reagan. He used to be the governor of California, but he was born in Tampico, Illinois. When he was in office, he could have been referred to as the governor of California from Illinois. Role player, then modifier. It would have sounded odd to refer to him as the governor from Illinois of California. Modifier, then role player. More pointedly, in 1964, Robert F. Kennedy's senatorial ambitions ran up against the inconvenient fact that both Massachusetts seats were already occupied, one by his younger brother Edward. So he simply took up residence in New York and ran for the U.S. Senate from there, soon becoming the senator from New York from Massachusetts. Not the senator from Massachusetts from New York, though that does come close to the joke that Bay Staters used to tell at the time that they lived in the only state entitled to three senators. Interestingly, what is true of N-bars and noun phrases is true of V-bars and verb phrases. Say that Sergei gave those documents to the spy in a hotel. The phrase, "to the spy," is one of the role players of the verb give. There is no such thing as giving without a getter. Therefore, "to the spy" lives with the head verb inside the V-bar. But "in a hotel" is a modifier, a comment, an afterthought, and is kept outside the V-bar, in the VP, the verb phrase. Thus, the phrases are inherently ordered. We can say, gave the documents to the spy in a hotel, but not, gave in a hotel the documents to the spy. When a head is accompanied by just one phrase, however, that phrase can be either a role player, inside the V-bar, or a modifier, outside the V-bar but inside the VP. And the actual order of the words is the same. Consider the following newspaper report. One witness told the commissioners that she had seen sexual intercourse taking place between two parked cars in front of her house. The aggrieved woman had a modifier interpretation in mind for between two parked cars, but twisted readers gave it a role-player interpretation. The fourth and final component of a phrase is a special position reserved for subjects, which linguists call spec, short for specifier. Don't ask. The subject is a special role player, usually the causal agent if there is one. For example, in the verb phrase, the guitarists destroy the hotel room, the phrase, the guitarists, is the subject. It is the causal agent of the event consisting of the hotel room being destroyed. Actually, noun phrases can have subjects too, as in the parallel NP, the guitarist's destruction of the hotel room. Now the story begins to get interesting. You must have noticed that noun phrases and verb phrases have a lot in common. One, a head, which gives the phrase its name and determines what it is about. Two, some role players, which are grouped with the head inside a sub-phrase. Three, modifiers, which appear outside the N or V bar. And four, a subject. The orderings inside a noun phrase and inside a verb phrase are the same. The noun comes before its role players. The destruction of the hotel room, not the of the hotel room destruction. And the verb comes before its role players, to destroy the hotel room, not to the hotel room destroy. The modifiers go to the right in both cases, the subject to the left. It seems as if there is a standard design to the two phrases. In fact, the design pops up all over the place. Take, for example, the prepositional phrase PP, in the hotel. It has a head, the preposition in, which means something like interior region, and then a role, the thing whose interior region is being picked out, in this case, a hotel. And the same goes for the adjective phrase AP in afraid of the wolf. The head adjective afraid occurs before its role player, the source of the fear. With this common design, there is no need to write out a long list of rules to capture what is inside a speaker's head. There may be just one pair of super rules for the entire language, where the distinctions among nouns, verbs, prepositions, and adjectives are collapsed, and all four are specified with a variable like X. Since a phrase just inherits the properties of its head, a tall man is a kind of man. It's redundant to call a phrase headed by a noun phrase. We could just call it an X phrase, since the nounhood of the head noun, like the manhood of the head noun and all the other information in the head noun, percolates up to characterize the whole phrase. Here is what the super rules sound like. XP consists of spec, X bar, YP, asterisk. A phrase consists of an optional subject followed by an X bar followed by any number of modifiers. X bar consists of X, ZP, asterisk. An X bar consists of a head word followed by any number of role players. Just plug in noun, verb, adjective, or preposition for X, Y, and Z, and you have the actual phrase structure rules that spell the phrases. This streamlined version of phrase structure is called the X-bar theory. This general blueprint for phrases extends even farther, to other languages. In English, the head of a phrase comes before its role players. In many languages, it is the other way around. But it is the other way around across the board, across all the kinds of phrases in a language. For example, in Japanese, the verb comes after its object, not before. They say Kenji sushi ate, not Kenji ate sushi. The preposition comes after its noun phrase, Kenji to, not to Kenji. So they are actually called postpositions. The adjective comes after its complement, Kenji than taller, not taller than Kenji. Even the words marking questions are flipped. They say roughly, Kenji eat did, not did Kenji eat. Japanese and English are looking glass versions of each other, and such consistency has been found in scores of languages. If a language has the verb before the object, as in English, it will also have prepositions. If it has the verb after the object, as in Japanese, it will have postpositions. This is a remarkable discovery. It means that the super rules suffice not only for all phrases in English, but for all phrases in all languages, with one modification, removing the left-to-right order from each super rule. The trees become mobiles. One of the rules would say, X-bar consists of ZP asterisk X. An X-bar is composed of a head X and any number of role players in either order. To get English, one appends a single bit of information saying that the order within an X-bar is head first. To get Japanese, that bit of information would say that the order is head last. Similarly, the other super rule, the one for phrases, can be distilled so that left-to-right order boils away, and an ordered phrase in a particular language can be reconstituted by adding back either X-bar first or X-bar last. The piece of information that makes one language different from another is called the parameter. In fact, the super rule is beginning to look less like an exact blueprint for a particular phrase and more like a general guideline or principle for what phrases must look like. The principle is usable only after you combine it with the language's particular setting for the order parameter. This general conception of grammar, first proposed by Chomsky, is called the principles and parameters theory. Chomsky suggests that the unordered super rules, principles, are universal and innate, and that when children learn a particular language, they do not have to learn a long list of rules because they were born knowing the super rules. All they have to learn is whether their particular language has the parameter value head first, as in English, or head last, as in Japanese. They can do that merely by noticing whether a verb comes before or after its object in any sentence in their parent's speech. If the verb comes before the object, as in, eat your spinach, the child concludes that the language is head first. If it comes after, as in, your spinach eat, the child concludes that the language is head last. Huge chunks of grammar are then available to the child all at once, as if the child were merely flipping a switch to one of two possible positions. If this theory of language learning is true, it would help solve the mystery of how children's grammar explodes into adult-like complexity in so short a time. They are not acquiring dozens or hundreds of rules. They are just setting a few mental switches. The principles and parameters of phrase structure specify only what kinds of ingredients may go into a phrase in what order. They do not spell out any particular phrase. Left to themselves, they would run amok and produce all kinds of mischief. Take a look at the following sentences, which all conform to the principles or super rules. The sentences in the first sequence sound right. Melvin dined. Melvin devoured the pizza. Melvin put the car in the garage. Sheila alleged that Bill is a liar. Those in the second sequence do not. Melvin dined the pizza. Melvin devoured. Melvin put. Melvin put the car. Melvin put in the garage. Sheila alleged the claim. Sheila alleged. It must be the verb's fault. Some verbs, like dine, refuse to appear in the company of a direct object noun phrase. Others, like Devour, won't appear without one. This is true even though dine and devour are very close in meaning, both being ways of eating. You may dimly recall from grammar lessons that verbs like dine are called intransitive, and verbs like devour are called transitive. But verbs come in many flavors, not just these two. The verb put is not content unless it has both an object, NP, the car, and a prepositional phrase, in the garage. The verb allege requires an embedded sentence, that Bill is a liar, and nothing else. Within a phrase, then, the verb is a little despot, dictating which of the slots made available by the super rules are to be filled. These demands are stored in the verb's entry in the mental dictionary, more or less as follows. Dine. Verb means to eat meal in a refined setting. Eater equals subject. Devour. Verb means to eat something ravenously. Eater equals subject. Thing eaten equals object. Put. Verb means to cause something to go to some place. Putter equals subject. Thing put equals object. Place equals prepositional object. Allege. Verb means to declare without proof. Declarer equals subject. Declaration equals complement sentence. Each of these entries lists a definition, in mentalese, of some kind of event, followed by the players that have roles in the event. The entry indicates how each role player may be plugged into the sentence, as a subject, an object, a prepositional object, an embedded sentence, and so on. For a sentence to feel grammatical, the verb's demands must be satisfied. Melvin devoured is bad because devourer's desire for a thing-eaten role is left unfulfilled. Melvin dined the pizza is bad because dine didn't order pizza or any other object. Because verbs have the power to dictate how a sentence conveys who did what to whom, one cannot sort out the roles in a sentence without looking up the verb. That is why your grammar teacher got it wrong when she told you that the subject of the sentence is the doer of the action. The subject of the sentence is often the doer, but only when the verb says so. The verb can also assign it other roles. The big bad wolf frightened the three little pigs. The subject is doing the frightening. The three little pigs feared the big bad wolf. The subject is being frightened. My true love gave me a partridge in a pear tree. The subject is doing the giving. I received a partridge in a pear tree from my true love. The subject is being given to. Dr. Nussbaum performed plastic surgery. The subject is operating on someone. Cheryl underwent plastic surgery. The subject is being operated on. In fact, many verbs have two distinct entries, each casting a different set of roles. This can give rise to a common kind of ambiguity, as in the old joke, "Call me a taxi." Okay, you're a taxi. In one of the Harlem Globetrotters routines, the referee tells Meadowlark Lemon to shoot the ball. Lemon points his finger at the ball and shouts, "Bang!" The comedian Dick Gregory tells of walking up to a lunch counter in Mississippi during the days of racial segregation. The waitress said to him, "We don't serve colored people." "That's fine," he replied. "I don't eat colored people. I'd like a piece of chicken." So how do we actually distinguish man bites dog from dog bites man? The dictionary entry for bite says, "The biter is the subject. The bitten thing is the object." But how do we find subjects and objects in the tree? Grammar puts little tags on the noun phrases that can be matched up with the roles laid out in a verb's dictionary entry. These tags are called cases. In many languages, cases appear as prefixes or suffixes on the nouns. For example, in Latin, the nouns for man and dog, homo and canis, change their endings depending on who is biting whom. Canis hominem mordet, not news. Homo canem mordet, news. Julius Caesar knew who bit whom because the noun corresponding to the bite he appeared with M at the end. Indeed, this allowed Caesar to find the biter and bite he even when the order of the two was flipped, which Latin allows. Hominem canis mordet means the same thing as canis hominem mordet, and canem homo mordet means the same thing as homo canem mordet. Thanks to case markers, verbs dictionary entries can be relieved of the duty of keeping track of where their role players actually appear in the sentence. A verb need only indicate that, say, the doer is a subject. Whether the subject is in first or third or fourth position in the sentence is up to the rest of the grammar, and the interpretation is the same. Indeed, in what are called scrambling languages, case markers are exploited even further. The article, adjective, and noun inside a phrase are each tagged with a particular case marker, and the speaker can scramble the words of the phrase all over the sentence. Say, put the adjective at the end for emphasis, knowing that the listener can mentally join them back up. This process, called agreement or concord, is a second engineering solution, aside from phrase structure itself, to the problem of encoding a tangle of interconnected thoughts into strings of words that appear one after the other. Centuries ago, English, like Latin, had suffixes that marked case overtly. But the suffixes have all eroded, and overt case survives only in the personal pronouns. I, he, she, we, they are used for the subject role. My, his, her, our, their are used for the possessor role. Me, him, her, us, them are used for all other roles. The who, whom distinction could be added to this list, but it is on the way out. In the United States, whom is used consistently only by careful writers and pretentious speakers. Interestingly, since we all know how to say he saw us, but never him saw we, the syntax of case must still be alive and well in English. Though nouns appear physically unchanged, no matter what role they play, they are tagged with silent cases. Alice realized this after spotting a mouse swimming nearby in her pool of tears. "Would it be of any use now," thought Alice, "to speak to this mouse? Everything is so out of the way down here that I should think very likely it can talk. At any rate, there's no harm in trying." So she began, "Oh, mouse, do you know the way out of this pool? I am very tired of swimming about here, oh, mouse." Alice thought this must be the right way of speaking to a mouse. She had never done such a thing before, but she remembered having seen, in her brother's Latin grammar, a mouse, of a mouse, to a mouse, oh, mouse. English speakers tag a noun phrase with a case by seeing what the noun is adjacent to, generally a verb or preposition. But for Alice's mouse, the archaic vocative case marker, O. They use these case tags to match up each noun phrase with its verb decreed role. The requirement that noun phrases must get case tags explains why certain sentences are impossible, even though the super rules admit them. For example, a direct object role player has to come right after the verb, before any other role player. One says, "Tell Mary that John is coming," not "Tell that John is coming, Mary." The reason is that the NP, Mary, cannot just float around tagless, but must be case-marked by sitting adjacent to the verb. Curiously, while verbs and prepositions can mark case on their adjacent NPs, nouns and adjectives cannot. Governor California and Afraid the Wolf, though interpretable, are ungrammatical. English demands that the meaningless preposition of precede the noun, as in Governor of California and Afraid of the Wolf, for no reason other than to give it a case tag. The sentences we utter are kept under tight rein by verbs and prepositions. Phrases cannot just show up anywhere they feel like in the VP, but must have a job description and be wearing an identity badge at all times. Thus, we cannot say things like, "Last night I slept bad dreams, a hangover, snoring, no pajamas, sheets were wrinkled," even though a listener could guess what that would mean. This marks a major difference between human languages and, for example, pigeons and the signing of chimpanzees, where any word can pretty much go anywhere. Now, what about the most important phrase of all? The sentence. If a noun phrase is a phrase built around a noun, and a verb phrase is a phrase built around a verb, what is a sentence built around? The critic Mary McCarthy once said of her rival, Lillian Hellman, "Every word she writes is a lie, including and the." The insult relies on the fact that a sentence is the smallest thing that can be either true or false. A single word cannot be either. So McCarthy is alleging that Hellman's lying extends deeper than one would have thought possible. A sentence, then, must express some kind of meaning that does not clearly reside in its nouns and verbs, but that embraces the entire combination and turns it into a proposition that can be true or false. Take, for example, the optimistic sentence, "The Red Sox will win the World Series." The word "will" does not apply to the Red Sox alone, nor to the World Series alone, nor to winning alone. It applies to an entire concept, the Red Sox winning the World Series. That concept is timeless and, therefore, truthless. It can refer equally well to some past glory, a hypothetical future one, even to the mere logical possibility, bereft of any hope that it will ever happen. But the word "will" pins the concept down to temporal coordinates, namely the stretch of time subsequent to the moment the sentence is uttered. If I declare, "The Red Sox will win the World Series," I can be right or wrong. Probably wrong, alas. The word "will" is an example of an auxiliary, a word that expresses layers of meaning having to do with the truth of a proposition as the speaker conceives it. These layers also include negation, as in won't and doesn't, necessity, must, and possibility, might and can. Auxiliaries typically occur at the periphery of sentence trees, mirroring the fact that they assert something about the rest of the sentence taken as a whole. The auxiliary is the head of the sentence in exactly the same way that a noun is the head of the noun phrase. Since the auxiliary is also called infill, for inflection, we can call the sentence an IP, an infill phrase or auxiliary phrase. Its subject position is reserved for the subject of the entire sentence, reflecting the fact that a sentence is an assertion that some predicate, the VP, is true of its subject. An auxiliary is an example of a function word, a different kind of word from nouns, verbs, and adjectives. The content words. Function words include articles, the, some, pronouns, he, she, the possessive marker, s, meaningless prepositions like of, words that introduce complements like that and to, and conjunctions like and or. Function words are bits of crystallized grammar. They delineate larger phrases into which NPs and VPs and APs fit, thereby providing a scaffolding for the sentence. Accordingly, the mind treats function words differently from content words. People add new content words to the language all the time, like the noun facts and the verb to snarf, meaning to retrieve a computer file. But the function words form a closed club that resists new members. That is why all the attempts to introduce gender-neutral pronouns like hesh and thon have failed. Recall, too, that patients with damage to the language areas of the brain have more trouble with function words like or, O-R, and be, B-E, than with content words like or, O-A-R, and be, B-E-E. When words are expensive, as in telegrams and headlines, writers tend to leave the function words out, hoping that the reader can reconstruct them from the order of the content words. But because function words are the most reliable clues to the phrase structure of the sentence, telegraphic language is always a gamble. A reporter once sent Cary Grant the telegram, "How old, Cary Grant?" He replied, "Old Cary Grant, fine." Here are some headlines from a collection called Squad Helps Dog Bite Victim, put together by the staff of the Columbia Journalism Review. New housing for elderly not yet dead. New Missouri U chancellor expects little sex. 12 on their way to cruise among dead in plane crash. New Jersey judge to rule on nude beach. Chow remains cremated. Chinese ape man dated. Hershey bars protest. Reagan wins on budget, but more lies ahead. Deer kill 130,000. Complaints about NBA referees growing ugly. Function words also capture much of what makes one language grammatically different from another. Though all languages have function words, the properties of the words differ in ways that can have large effects on the structure of the sentences in the language. We have already seen one example. Overt case and agreement markers in Latin allow noun phrases to be scrambled. Silent ones in English force them to remain in place. Function words capture the grammatical look and feel of a language, as in these passages that use a language's function words, but none of its content words. Der Jammerfolk. Es brillig war. Die schlichte Toven. Wirten and Wimmelten in Waben. Le Jezerok. Il brillig, l'étove lubricieux, seguir en vriant dans le guave. The effect can also be seen in passages that take the function words from one language but the content words from another, like the following pseudo-German notice that used to be posted in many university computing centers in the English-speaking word. Achtung! Alles Luckenspiepers. Das Computermaschine ist nicht für Gefingerpoken und Mittengraben. Ist easy schnappen der Springenwerk. Blauen Fusen und Pappenkorken mit Spitzensparken. Ist nicht für Gewerken bei das Dumpfkaufen. Das Rubernecken Sightseeren kiepen das Cottonpicken Hans in das Pockets muss. Relaxen und watchen das Blinkenlichten. Turnabout being fair play, computer operators in Germany have posted a translation into pseudo-English. Attention! This room is fulfilled mit special elektronische equipment. Finger grabbing and pressing the knob keys from the computer is allowed for D experts only. So all the left-handers stay away. And do not disturb in the brainstorming fun here working intelligences. Otherwise you will be outthrown and kicked andesfair. Also, please keep still, and only watchen astonished the blinken lights. Anyone who goes to cocktail parties knows that one of Chomsky's main contributions to intellectual life is the concept of deep structure, together with the transformations that map it onto surface structure. When Chomsky introduced the terms in the behaviorist climate of the early 1960s, the reaction was sensational. Deep structure came to refer to everything that was hidden, profound, universal, or meaningful, and before long there was talk of the deep structure of visual perception, stories, myths, poems, paintings, musical compositions, and so on. Anticlimactically, I must now divulge that deep structure is a prosaic technical gadget in grammatical theory. It is not the meaning of a sentence, nor is it what is universal across all human languages. Though universal grammar and abstract phrase structures seem to be permanent features of grammatical theory, many linguists, including in his most recent writings Chomsky himself, think one can do without deep structure per se. To discourage all the hype incited by the word deep, linguists now usually refer to it as destructure. The concept is actually quite simple. Recall that for a sentence to be well-formed, the verb must get what it wants. All the roles listed in the verb's dictionary entry must appear in their designated positions. But in many sentences, the verb does not seem to be getting what it wants. Remember that put requires a subject, an object, and a prepositional phrase. He put the car and he put in the garage sound incomplete. How, then, do we account for the following perfectly good sentences? The car was put in the garage. What did he put in the garage? Where did he put the car? In the first sentence, put seems to be doing fine without an object, which is out of character. Indeed, now it rejects one. The car was put, the Toyota, in the garage is awful. In the second sentence, put also appears in public, objectless. In the third, its obligatory prepositional phrase is missing. Does this mean we need to add new dictionary entries for put, allowing it to appear in some places without its object or its prepositional phrase? Obviously not, or he put the car and he put in the garage would slip back in. In some sense, of course, the required phrases really are there. They're just not where we expect them. In the first sentence, a passive construction, the NP, the car, playing the role of thing put, which ordinarily would be the object, shows up in the subject position instead. In the second sentence, a wha question, that is, a question formed with who, what, where, when, or why, the thing put role is expressed by the word what and shows up at the beginning. In the third sentence, the place role also shows up at the beginning instead of after the object where it ordinarily belongs. A simple way to account for the entire pattern is to say that every sentence has two phrase structures. The phrase structure we have been talking about so far, the one defined by the super rules, is the deep structure. Deep structure is the interface between the mental dictionary and phrase structure. In the deep structure, all the role players for put appear in their expected places. Then a transformational operation can move a phrase to a previously unfilled slot elsewhere in the tree. That is where we find the phrase in the actual sentence. This new tree is the surface structure, now called S structure, because as a mere surface representation, it never used to get proper respect. In the deep structure, was put the car in the garage, the car is where the verb wanted it. In the surface structure, the position from which the phrase was moved contains an inaudible symbol that was left behind by the movement transformation called a trace. The car was put trace in the garage. The trace serves as a reminder of the role that the moved phrase is playing. It tells us that to find out what the car is doing in the putting event, we should look up the object slot in the entry for the verb put. That slot says thing put. Thanks to the trace, the surface structure contains the information needed to recover the meaning of the sentence. The original deep structure, which was used only to plug in the right sets of words from the lexicon, plays no role. Why do languages bother with separate deep structures and surface structures? Because it takes more than just keeping the verb happy, what deep structure does, to have a usable sentence. A given concept often has to play one kind of role, defined by the verb in the verb phrase, and simultaneously a separate role, independent of the verb, defined by some other layer of the tree. Consider the difference between beavers build dams and its passive, dams are built by beavers. Down in the verb phrase, the level of who did what to whom, the nouns are playing the same roles in both sentences. Beavers do the building, dams get built. But up at the sentence, IP level, the level of subject-predicate relations, of what is being asserted to be true of what, they are playing different roles. The active sentence is saying something about beavers in general, and happens to be true. The passive sentence is saying something about dams in general, and happens to be false, since some dams, like the Grand Coulee Dam, are not built by beavers. The surface structure, which puts dams in the sentence's subject position, but links it to a trace of its original verb phrase position, allows the cake to be both eaten and had. The ability to move phrases around while still retaining their roles also gives the speaker of a rigid word order language like English a bit of wiggle room. For example, phrases that are ordinarily buried deep in the tree can be moved too early in the sentence, where they can hook up with material fresh in the listener's mind. For example, if a play-by-play announcer has been describing Nevin Marquardt's progression down the ice, he could say, "Marquardt spears Gretzky." But if it was Wayne Gretzky the announcer had been describing, he would say, "Gretzky is speared by Marquardt." Moreover, because a passive participle has the option of leaving the doer role, ordinarily the subject, unfilled in deep structure, it is useful when one wants to avoid mentioning that role altogether, as in Ronald Reagan's evasive concession, "Mistakes were made." Hooking up players with different roles in different scenarios is something that grammar excels at. In a "wha" question like, "What did he put, trace, in the garage?" the noun phrase "what" gets to live a double life. Down in the "who did what to whom" realm of the verb phrase, the position of the trace indicates that the entity has the role of the thing being put. Up in the "what is being asserted of what" realm of the sentence, the word "what" indicates that the point of the sentence is to ask the listener to provide the identity of something. If a logician were to express the meaning behind the sentence, it would be something like, "For which X, John put X in the garage." When these movement operations are combined with other components of syntax, as in, "She was told by Bob to be examined by a doctor," or, "Who did he say that Barry tried to convince to leave?" or, "Tex is fun for anyone to tease," the components interact to determine the meaning of the sentence in chains of deduction as intricate and precise as the workings of a fine Swiss watch. Now that I have dissected syntax in front of you, I hope your reaction is more favorable than Eliza Doolittle's or Jack Cade's. At the very least, I hope you are impressed at how syntax is a Darwinian organ of extreme perfection and complication. Syntax is complex, but the complexity is there for a reason. For our thoughts are surely even more complex, and we are limited by a mouth that can pronounce a single word at a time. Science has begun to crack the beautifully designed code that our brains use to convey complex thoughts and words and their orderings. The workings of syntax are important for another reason. Grammar offers a clear refutation of the empiricist doctrine that there is nothing in the mind that was not first in the senses. Traces, cases, X-bars, and the other paraphernalia of syntax are colorless, odorless, and tasteless. But they, or something like them, must be a part of our unconscious mental life. This should not be surprising to a thoughtful computer scientist. There is no way one can write a halfway intelligent program without defining variables and data structures that do not directly correspond to anything in the input or output. For example, a graphics program that had to store an image of a triangle inside a circle would not store the actual keystrokes that the user typed to draw the shapes, because the same shapes could have been drawn in a different order, or with a different device like a mouse or a light pen. Nor would it store the list of dots that have to be lit up to display the shapes on a video screen, because the user might later want to move the circle around and leave the triangle in place, or make the circle bigger or smaller, and one long list of dots would not allow the program to know which dots belong to the circle and which to the triangle. Instead, the shapes would be stored in some more abstract format, like the coordinates of a few defining points for each shape, a format that mirrors neither the inputs nor the outputs to the program, but that can be translated to and from them when the need arises. Grammar, a form of mental software, must have evolved under similar design specifications. Though psychologists under the influence of empiricism often suggest that grammar mirrors commands to the speech muscles, melodies in speech sounds, or mental scripts for the ways that people and things tend to interact, I think all these suggestions miss the mark. Grammar is a protocol that has to interconnect the ear, the mouth, and the mind, three very different kinds of machine. It cannot be tailored to any of them, but must have an abstract logic of its own. The idea that the human mind is designed to use abstract variables and data structures used to be, and in some circles still is, a shocking and revolutionary claim, because the structures have no direct counterpart in the child's experience. Some of the organization of grammar would have to be there from the start, part of the language learning mechanism that allows children to make sense out of the noises they hear from their parents. The details of syntax have figured prominently in the history of psychology because they are a case where complexity in the mind is not caused by learning. Learning is caused by complexity in the mind. And that was real news. Chapter 5. Words, words, words. The word glamour comes from the word grammar. And since the Chomskyan revolution, the etymology has been fitting. Who could not be dazzled by the creative power of the mental grammar, by its ability to convey an infinite number of thoughts with a finite set of rules? There has been a book on mind and matter called Grammatical Man, and a Nobel Prize lecture comparing the machinery of life to a generative grammar. Chomsky has been interviewed in Rolling Stone and alluded to on Saturday Night Live. In Woody Allen's story, The Whore of Mensa, the patron asks, "Suppose I wanted Noam Chomsky explained to me by two girls." "It'd cost you," she replies. Unlike the mental grammar, the mental dictionary has had no cachet. It seems like nothing more than a humdrum list of words, each transcribed into the head by dull-witted rote memorization. In the preface to his dictionary, Samuel Johnson wrote, "It is the fate of those who dwell at the lower employments of life to be rather driven by the fear of evil than attracted by the prospect of good, to be exposed to censure without hope of praise, to be disgraced by miscarriage or punished for neglect, where success would have been without applause and diligence without reward." Among these unhappy mortals is the writer of dictionaries. Johnson's own dictionary defines lexicographer as "a harmless drudge that busies himself in tracing the original and detailing the signification of words." In this chapter, we will see that the stereotype is unfair. The world of words is just as wondrous as the world of syntax, or even more so. For not only are people as infinitely creative with words as they are with phrases and sentences, but memorizing individual words demands its own special virtuosity. Recall the WUG test passed by any preschooler? Here is a WUG. Now there are two of them. There are two... Before being so challenged, the child has neither heard anyone say nor been rewarded for saying the word WUGs. Therefore, words are not simply retrieved from a mental archive. People must have a mental rule for generating new words from old ones, something like, to form the plural of a noun, add the suffix s. The engineering trick behind human language, its being a discrete combinatorial system, is used in at least two different places. Sentences and phrases are built out of words by the rules of syntax, and the words themselves are built out of smaller bits by another set of rules, the rules of morphology. The creative powers of English morphology are pathetic compared to what we find in other languages. The English noun comes in exactly two forms, duck and ducks.